We are back with Alan Dershowitz, Bill Russell, and I, Paula Gordon. This business of process, this is a relatively new idea, but much of what you talk, to me, much of what you talk about, especially in The Genesis of Justice, your newest book, is talking about looking at very ancient things with a new eye.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what the Bible wants us to do. It is a book that's supposed to be for the ages. It's a book that has endured longer than any other book. Nobody reads the Code of Hammurabi today. People read the Bible. And I think it's so enduring because it has stories that are compelling, but that don't give us answers, just raise questions. And they require reinterpretation. There's an old Jewish saying that says the Bible has 70 faces, and everyone is different. I think it has 1,000 faces. Every generation reads these stories anew and requires new interpretations. The interpretation I gave about the governor of Illinois obviously grows out of something that just happened, and yet it gave me additional insight into his decision by thinking about Abraham's argument with God. But Abraham, you say, was a man of great courage to argue with God about strangers, but then God comes down and says, all right, wise guy, now I'm going to give you a direct command. Take your own son, the one you love, bring him up to the mountain and sacrifice him to me. Abraham doesn't make a peep. The same Abraham who argues about strangers accepts this horrible sentence on his own son. He doesn't even say to God, look, God, you gave Noah a law that says, don't shed human blood. Now you're telling me to shed human blood. Make up your mind, God. Am I supposed to obey your commandment to Noah, or am I supposed to obey your direct commandment to me? But Abraham just accepts it and raises his hand against his son. It would be attempted murder under the law of most states in the United States, and yet we praise him as a great patriarch. That story requires interpretation.
And how do you interpret that, please?
Well, Kierkegaard interpreted it. Kant interpreted it. Everybody throughout history who has any intelligence has thought about this story and interpreted it in different ways. I think of it as a test that Abraham failed. I think God was challenging Abraham. You argued with me. Let's see if you really have the courage to continue to argue with me. And it's interesting because when the first time Isaac is described, it says, God says to Abraham, bring me your son, your only son, the one you love. When Abraham raises his hand and almost kills him, God, the angel, then says, do not kill your son, your only son. It leaves out the one you love.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if he had forfeited his right to love his son because he didn't argue vigorously enough for his life.
Now, I think that there would be people who would listen to what you're saying and say, this is on the verge of being sacrilegious, that one should talk about God this way.
Jerry Falwell described my book. Well, no, he loves my book. He described it as heresy at its best. And he basically says, better to argue with the Bible than ignore it. You know, the Jewish tradition is one that encourages heresy, up to a point. Spinoza was excommunicated. I think we now realize that was a big mistake. But you're supposed to challenge. Abraham challenged. Why can't we challenge?
In fact, don't you say that it's an obligation to do that?
It's an obligation to argue with God, I believe. But, you know, I'm making a more radical statement. I'm saying the God of Genesis is an imperfect God, a learning God, a God who makes mistakes, a God who repents the creation of human beings, a God who looks down and says, wait a minute, I have a problem here. I created these human beings in my image. They're bad. What does that say about me? And he realizes that he has to be controlled also, and so he makes a covenant. Whoever heard of a God making an agreement? But in the Bible, God makes a covenant, first with Noah, then with Abraham, then with Jacob, and then with Moses. And he's bound by the covenant.
I was quite taken by the idea that God decided he'd made a mistake,
yeah,
and that he was going to try this again. And in four or five different ways, you talk about God, and you treat this as a divinely inspired book.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about God as also being in process.
God is in process. The God that eventually ends up in the New Testament, the perfect God with the perfect Son, the God that eventually ends up in the Quran, the God with the perfect prophet Muhammad, is not the God of Genesis. The God of Genesis is not the God of Job. The God of Job is an arrogant God who doesn't even accept an argument from Job. He says to Job, he pulls rank on Job. Basically, he says, how dare you? Were you here when I created the world? Do you know what makes the heavens work? How dare you question my justice? Has anybody before ever questioned my justice? Job should have said, yeah, Abraham, and you liked him.
He wasn't quite as quick on his feet as Abraham. Now, this is interesting, your articulation of that, because it sounds like if you look at Genesis, from the Genesis perspective, that we are approaching perfection we're not approaching perfection, that this is an ongoing discussion. Mm-hmm. And yet you talk about the perfection manifested in the latter incarnations in the Muslim faith and the Christian faith. And it's as if at some stage we began to approach perfection and either got there or approaching it asymptotically. That is to say, we'll never quite get there.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are fundamentally different perspectives. One is very dynamic, ultimately, mm-hmm. and the other is very static.
I agree. And I think there are differences. Somebody observed the other day to me that the difference between Judaism and Christianity is Judaism encourages argument within. And that's why there are really only three Judaisms, conservative, reform, and orthodox. Christianity has 2,000 sects. Because you have an argument in Christianity, you got to create a new church. You can't have a church in which there's disagreement, whereas Judaism encourages disagreement. Oh, Christians argue. Look, the Catholics have argued among themselves. Jesuits are the best arguers in the world. I mean, their interpretations.
They've also had some practice.
Right. Their interpretations of the Bible are absolutely marvelous. I've learned an enormous amount from them. But, you know, anybody who's my age, who's lived through the Holocaust, who's seen members of his own family perish, who's seen the failure to punish the perpetrators of the Holocaust. The Germans lived such good lives after the Marshall Plan. You have to wonder about God's justice. And that's why I like the notion of an imperfect God, a God who can't bring everything about that he chooses to. What I dislike is the trivial God of the football game, the God that people pray to before the football game, saying, God who couldn't prevent the Holocaust, why don't you come down and make me win this football game? Or the guy who crosses himself before taking a foul shot at a basketball game, seeking God's help and dunking the shot. I mean, what kind of a God would you expect to help you win a trivial game and would stand aside and not prevent the AIDS epidemic or Rwanda or Cambodia?
A personal God, which seems that this is getting far ahead, but it appears in your articulation that there is an absolute requirement in order for to base justice and society more broadly on a theocratic basis, on a theological basis, mm-hmm. that ultimately requires an afterlife for all the reasons you mentioned.
Right. And the afterlife comes late.
Well,
the
afterlife comes late, but it also ultimately, the way it is generally interpreted, essentially is individual salvation. Mm-hmm. That is to say, what this forces is a sort of radical individualization. So you end up with this personal relationship with the deity where you're going to get a payoff mm-hmm. somewhere down the line. And it leads to the kinds of things you're talking about with a basketball player standing praying for the right. individual salvation with respect to this particular act.
And, yep. And I do think it makes religion too selfish to say, believe in God. You know, it's the Pascal wager. The great French mathematician Pascal said, look, you must bet. If you bet that there is a God and there isn't one, so you wasted a few hours of prayer. If you bet that there is no God and there is one, you're in real trouble. So you better bet that there is one, even if you have doubts whether there is one. I can't imagine a God who would appreciate that kind of cost-benefit calculation. You know, maybe the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard or the business school.
Well, a capitalist God might.
Right.
Right. Could raise some other issues, maybe.
My friend Harvey Cox wrote a wonderful book about...
Harvey Cox is a wonderful theological thinker of this...
theologian and my colleague and friend. He wrote a wonderful book as God of the Markets, and he looks as to how economists look at the markets, the invisible hand, Adam Smith, and all that, and he says it's a very religious concept when you think about it. But Harvey likes to be very inclusive and make sure that everybody is included within the context of believers.
This is Alan Dershowitz. He's going to be back with us in just a moment when Bill Russell and I return with the Paula Gordon Show. Please stay tuned.